Welcome to Free Energy Now. I'm your host, Sterling Allen. We have a special guest today, Murray King, who has spent a lot of his adult life studying various alternative energies, starting out with his thesis on some outside-the-box stuff, and he's been pushing the envelope ever since. He's written two books on zero-point energy, and with the name Murray King, you can imagine he actually knows a lot about T. Henry Murray, and has actually given a number of conference symposia presentations on T. Henry Murray. This last July, he gave a presentation in Salt Lake called Water Dissociation Using Zero-Point Energy. It was a fascinating presentation. I was there, and he and I were speaking this evening, just kind of touching bases, and I talked him into coming on this show at last minute's notice. I appreciate him doing that. He's one of those people who can do that because he's the walking encyclopedia on the subject. Murray, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, Sterling. It's fun to be aboard.
Yeah, you've been... I was doing a little bit of reading of something that Gene Manning had written about you and your life. Tell us that story about your... was it your dissertation where you... What was that about?
I completed my undergraduate degree in electrical engineering. I got a master's in systems engineering, and I finished a coursework in systems engineering for my PhD at the University of Pennsylvania. And it's about that time, it was 1974, that when we had the big oil crisis, that I discovered the zero-point energy in the book by Meisner, Thorne, and Wheeler, Gravitation. And I asked the question, is that energy really there? And I started researching it. And it turns out that there was a lot of discussions in the physics literature, especially the journals, that treated the energy as a reality, the energy of empty space being fluctuations of electromagnetic field energy, kind of like microscopic lightning at a very small scale, very random, very chaotic. And I asked the question, can this energy be tapped as an energy source? And that's what I wanted to pursue for my dissertation. The problem was not one professor in the engineering school ever heard of it. And I ended up taking classes in quantum mechanics and that sort of thing to learn more about it. And the answer is, it appears to be, at first the professor said, no, it's random, chaotic, random things must ever remain random, that's the law of entropy. And then in 1977, Ilya Prigogine wins the Nobel Prize in Chemistry for showing how systems may evolve from a chaotic state to a self-organized state. And there was conditions that were required of the system. And it turned out that the zero-point energy and its behavior matched those conditions that Prigogine described. And that essentially became the basis for my thesis and my presentations ever since. That the energy can be triggered into a self-organizational form because it's highly interactive with matter.
There was another presentation at the conference by David Urth about self-organized criticality. Did you listen to that presentation?
Yes, he did a very good job. And it was, in fact, it was somewhat similar to some of the ideas I presented a year before on self-organization in plasmas. Where vortices and vortex rings form up. And the way it relates to zero-point energy, it turns out that in so many self-organizational forms in plasmas, it appears like they organize some of the vacuum energy and couple to it, especially when the nuclei of the plasma move in a vortex form.
Now, the thing that's really nice about if we could ever do this, and I remember Gene Manning's wording was that you were talking about being able to harness the energy of space, so to speak, which is all around us all the time, and it's inexhaustible, essentially. So in contrast to our present energy scenario, solar comes and goes, wind comes and goes. Fossil fuel has to be continually replenished. You have to fill your tank. Zero-point energy, on the other hand, if we could learn how to harness this, you could be anywhere at any time, and your power source is there with you. It never diminishes. The only thing that would diminish would be maybe the device that harnesses it. If it's a mechanical device, it might need to have some servicing. If it's a solid-state device, it might get dusty, rusty, and otherwise deteriorate. But other than that, you have this continuously running energy source, so you could have a cell phone that never needs to be recharged. You have and on. It's just a fascinating concept. And so this is what's been driving you. Is that correct all these years, is to try and learn how to harness this in a meaningful way?
Essentially, that's it. And I've seen that many inventors have stumbled across doing the right things, especially interacting with plasmas and electrical discharges that activate the energy and couple it to the system.
So you're saying that some of these technologies where inventors are using the word over-unity, for example, where they're getting more energy out on the backside than what they put in on the front side, that they may be tapping into zero-point energy. And in the presentation that you gave last month, you actually were going through some of the modeling of how this might be happening on a quantum level, of how, for example, these electrolysis systems, where they're getting 7, 10, 100 times the efficiency of what Faraday said would be possible in an electrolysis scenario, they're getting many times over that, and you actually went through some modeling of how that could be via the harnessing of zero-point energy.
That's correct. It centers on the concept very similar to making ball lightning, except on a microscopic level, that in the case of abrupt electrical discharges, there can be a formation in the plasma that actually activates and traps a little bit of the vacuum energy coherently into the ball lightning-like structure. Ken Shoulders is very notable for having studied these. These are microscopic forms of these charge clusters that there are, he calls them EVs for electron volitum, or he's actually named them EVOs for exotic vacuum objects. If you Google Ken Shoulders' name, you'll get to his website and his stuff. But he's done years and years of experimental work showing that when you make these, they have excess energy. And currently, there's a laboratory in the Ukraine called Proton Laboratory that's making big versions of them, and they're getting huge energy anomalies, including transmutation events when they hit targets with them, something else that Ken Shoulders has observed. And that's one of the evidences that you have a lot of excess energy trapping from the vacuum energy, because to create a transmutation event, transmuting elements, is considered impossible at these low energy levels, according to standard science.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one of the indicators, in my opinion, that show that something very special is happening at the energetic level.
And, I should go ahead and finish.
That show that you're actually trapping and cohering vacuum energy into these plasma forms that are often called plasmoids, or like ball lightning. In this case, Ken studies them at a microscopic level.
So these people, for example, MagniGas and StarTech, where they're taking high-intensity plasma arc and they're taking an inflow of sewage, trash, they're running it through this arc, dissociating it into its elemental components, a gas comes out which can be burned, and there's a solid component that comes out that is inert, and they're noting some over-unity scenarios as well. You think that that's in play there?
Very possible. Systems that employ abrupt electrical discharges, the more abrupt the better, by the way, they can often launch microscopically these EV forms, or these small clusters that seem to have excess energy. And if they're skillful, it's quite a trick to trap the energy from those, because they're typically quite destructive whenever they hit something. When an EV, for example, hits a conductor, it creates a crater, and much of the energy is spent in damaging the material that it hits. So that's one of the problems that Ken had in trying to make a practical system from generating EVs, just because they are destructive whenever they hit something.
I should mention, just as a footnote, that from my observation of, you know, one thing we do at the New Energy Congress is we review different energy technologies, inventors, claims, companies, and Ken Childers gets a huge thumbs up from those people who are more educated in our Congress, who have read his stuff or familiar with his stuff. So he has a very high level of credibility among in the field of people who are outside the box, but are who are academically based, I should say.
Yeah, it'd be great if they could replicate his work at universities. They would see some astounding anomalies and could help break open the field and more importantly, interest some very good minds to enter it and help research it.
Now, I was trying to look on the Internet to try and get a little more background on you before our interview, and I wasn't able to get to the information that, if I remember right, you're presently teaching on the college, university level, something like that?
No, I just do a day job. I'm a software engineer.
Okay.
And that's where the money is. There's very little employment, as you know, in this new energy field because it's so out of the paradigm that very few people believe it, especially people in authority.
Mm-hmm. You were talking in our conversation earlier about how there are certain topics which become kind of pariah-ish. You don't use the word cold fusion. You don't use the word zero-point energy as a source of usable energy. It's like academia will not even study it. It's like they've closed their minds, closed the book. What will it take to get through that kind of barrier, through that the labeling and the pariah, the how they've turned this into a almost a scarlet letter type of thing?
I think a good lesson for that is Thomas Kuhn's The Structure of Scientific Revolution, Thomas Kuhn's book that talks about the psychology and the sociology of events about paradigm changes in science. Ironically enough, this is not such a huge paradigm change. The vacuum energy has been recognized to exist since the 1930s, the advent of quantum mechanics. And Dirac popularized it back in those years for the basis of quantum electrodynamics, showing that the energy was part of space. The issue is not that the energy's there. The issue is that you could actually tap it for appreciable amounts of energy. It's accepted that you can tap it for small amounts. But for some reason, it's just not allowed to be discussed that you could tap it for large amounts of energy. And I think what it would take to change it is simply what it takes to change any paradigm. It's just a massive replication of an experiment where the experiment proves it, and it just doesn't go away. Most of academia will ignore those experiments, but if the experiment's simple enough that it can be done ideally by hobbyists, people at home, then eventually enough replication will punch it through, and then new people in academia will be willing to study it.
And you were saying that you spent the last year looking at basically these different electrolysis, Brown's gas, people who are looking at some unusual phenomena that are coming out of these electrolysis units, these systems, very unusual properties. Many people who have seen the Denny Klein video, for example, where he waves this torch across his hand in 1 second, and the next second he's sublimating tungsten, which has like a 4,000 degrees, it's way up there,
right.
Melting point. And so there's something going on that's beyond. It's not heat that's coming out of there. There's something going on that is an unusual property that science has not yet characterized or even acknowledged to a certain extent.
Ken Childers has some insight on that through his studies of EEVs. He showed that he can accurately measure the small power on each capacitor, the energy on each capacitor that launches an EV, and he could show it's in the nanowatt, picowatt region, and he could show that the damage that was done in the crater was, if it were heat, would be way, way too much compared to the energy put in. And he suggests that the nature of the charge cluster actually causes bond disassociation that ends up mimicking the melt, but it's not heat. It's a coherent form that disassociates the electron bonds in the metal, which is a very, very interesting hypothesis. And when you think about Brown's gas, that could easily be the same hypothesis, that in these gaseous plasma forms are very similar to the EVs. So when they hit the tungsten, they cause the electron bonds to let go. It appears to be melting for the weld, but the actual kinetic temperature is quite low. And so that would be a completely new and anomalous experimental proof that something's quite new, and academia could study that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's straight up off of the Brown's gas phenomena.
Now, when we start talking on an atomic level and a quantum level, the imagination could go into looking at maybe a chain reaction that we see with the atomic reaction, for example, where you have an atomic blast and you have a huge explosion from very little matter nuclear input that begins that explosion. And do you think it's possible that the zero-point energy, as we start tapping into it, that we may bump into something accidentally that we may wish we never did, annihilating the planet or annihilating a city or, some kind of a big oops?
Theoretically, when you look at the numbers that they describe for the energy densities and things like that, no one knows. It's just unknown.
Well, let's get back to this thing you were talking earlier about massive replications, and you and I were talking earlier about how the numbers of people who are replicating these Brown's gas scenarios is getting upwards in probably the low thousands, possibly, of people who have, garage experimenters. These are not academia. These are just hobbyists who have taken the plans from George Wiseman and others that they make available on their website and build these things, make the gas, experiment with it. And so there's a lot of people. I'm seeing, right now I'm subscribed to a number of water fuel cell types of mailing lists, discussion lists, and people are just doing this left and right. I'm just seeing results all over the place. I reported one in our news today, at Aaron Nakakami or something like that over in, I don't know where he's from, that's actually a Japanese last name, but Western first name. But, he shows a Stanley Myers type of setup where he's putting in a certain amount of wattage and you see these bubbles pouring off of his electrodes. Really quite impressive. I was talking to Mark Danzi later today, and he was saying that he didn't think that was really that remarkable. He's seen things quite more remarkable than that. He's also chasing this electrolysis science very carefully and closely and rigor. I mean, he's going at it in a commercial end in mind, and he's got some money to that. And he's pulling together teams, and so there's a lot of movement going on in that field. And as you've looked at that, you made the comment to the effect that that to you is very exciting because now there's all these people who are coming forward with what you consider to be proof of zero point energy as a practical, usable force through and this is one of the mechanisms that we harness it.
Yes, I think it is. The probably the most exciting thing as I was doing the research is seeing the improvements in the apparatus itself. What has been discovered and is quite now readily shared is that when you shrink the device and make the spacing of the plates very small, in the order of a millimeter apart, and you increase the frequency, getting it up there in the 40 kilohertz region or near the Keeley water disassociation frequency that Keeley discovered at the turn of the century, around 42.8 kilohertz, that they are seeing tremendous production of the gas with extremely small amounts of energy, where they can cut the current way back. They don't have to add any electrolyte to the cell. They drive it at a very high frequency, and then they can, and then it, since the cell's characteristic doesn't hold at one frequency for the optimal result, they have constant adjustments, small adjustments in the frequency to continually optimize the output. And what's exciting is to see the claims of well over unity. I've read 3x, 10x, 7x by the different various researchers in the field out there on the web. And this has prompted many, many more people to jump in and try it because it's simply not that hard to build the apparatus. It's not that hard to build the MOSFET solid-state circuits to drive it. Much easier than Stan Myers' approach using analog circuits. Dave Lawton was a good provider of a starting circuit for people to try, and things have improved. Recently, Paul Seguras made quite a bit of press on the Internet for making a circuit where he wobbles the frequency around the characteristic center frequency and is able to, just by keeping a little sweep going, able to always hit a great operating point on each cycle to produce lots and lots of gas for very little energy input, which means that if you're well over unity, now you have sufficient energy to drive your motor or keep your generator running, keep the electrical excitation going, and that's why people are making these water cars. And the only thing wrong with the water car projects is people are saying the water is the energy source, and that makes it look foolish as far as the academic community is concerned, because they know it costs you more energy to break apart water than you get back when you burn the hydrogen. Mm-hmm. But that's not what's going on energetically. The act of these pulsing systems between these plates, microscopically, is producing these charge class gas clusters, water clusters, charge water gas clusters, is what I've been calling it. And they are very much like in a water form, a water gas form, like the EVs and the ball lightning type of thing. And they have excess energy in them. And there are two decay modes. They can decay back to water and create an implosion event when it's in a cylinder, or they can also decay into hydrogen and oxygen, and of course now you have hydrogen. And the whole point was you got it much cheaper. Your excitation energy was much, much less than what would normally require to disassociate the water and the energy of that made these charge clusters are trapping vacuum, zero-point energy, or vacuum energy in them, and that's the actual energy source behind the disassociation, as well as creating this high energetic state of a water gas cluster that is known as brown gas, brown gas across the people that study it. And perhaps the two outstanding anomalies on this gas that need to be studied thoroughly is the implosion effect. Also, when it implodes and discharges in that manner, people can feel an electric shock, implying there's a polarization associated with it. And the other is that there's reports, presumably reports of actual causing transmutation events. If they're on studies where they, I'm not familiar with the details of these studies, but if they hit a target, they can start to transmute the nuclei, and that puts them right there in the same class as Ken Scholder's charge clusters. So I've been calling them charge water gas clusters, and I found a little bit of evidence on the research. In the standard literature, they call these forms actually hydrated electrons. That's the phrases that was used.
That's in academia, right?
Yeah, in the standard journals. I cite it in my talk. By the way, I did email you the...
Yeah, I got that. I'm going to be posting it on my website.
Everybody can go to your website and get the references to this.
Yeah, that'll be at PezWiki, and we'll link to that. I'll upload it to freeenergynews.com, but link to it from a PezWiki page that I'm actually just created a beginning of one this evening that will be called Water Dissociation Using Zero-Point Energy, and it'll be basically an outline and list of links, including a link to this PowerPoint presentation. And let me just put in a plug for that. I was very impressed with the number of references that you had and links And I remember making a note to myself that I wanted to get a copy of that PowerPoint presentation because of the number of references you make available there. It's just very exhaustive. You've been taking notes for a year, and then you gave it to us in a Reader's Digest distillation in a 1 hour or so presentation. It was just fantastic. You're a very good presenter, and you were able to pull together a lot of information in a very clear way. And along those lines, could you give us a lay of the land in terms of, there's a lot of electrolysis scenarios out there. Some people are using pulse, some people are using circular chambers like in a Joule cell arrangement, some people are using flat things, some are using round, some, you know, there's a lot of electrolysis scenarios out there. Which ones, and what is it that is causing them to, and is it only Brown's gas that is evoking this phenomena of tapping zero-point energy? Are there other modalities in an electrolysis analog that are also harvesting zero-point energy? And in similar to the electromagnetic spectrum where you have low frequency to high frequency, could you maybe just give us a thumbnail sketch of the electrolysis world, the different kinds of electrolysis units, and where we're seeing these effects where people are getting more energy out than what they put in? And, of course, they can go to your PowerPoint presentation to get references where they can look, read more on these things.
Yeah, I actually saw a pattern to these various the various apparatus that were doing it, producing it. And you get a little bit out if you just use the two plates, but you do a lot better when you use more. It seems like you get a little better if you use concentric cylinders, and you do a lot better when you make things closer together. So if you had concentric cylinders extremely close together, like a millimeter or less, that would do best. But of course, that's the hardest to manufacture. Mm-hmm. Parallel plates are very easy to get close together, and there's been lots of success on that score. And the excitative, you can get some effects with DC and some effects with AC and a little more with pulsed DC or just pulsing waveforms, square waves, and you do a lot better as you increase the frequency and get up towards what Keeley discovered as the water disassociation frequency. He said, gee, when you draw ultrasonics, he was studying it with sonics and ultrasonics. By the way, if you just Google Keeley, you'll get to the two big websites for Keeley, KeeleyNet. And
John Keeley, right?
Yeah, and I think Dale Pond has a very nice website referencing that work. Well, he was studying sonic and ultrasonic excitation, and he found that at ultrasonic frequencies around 42.8 kilohertz, he would make the water disappear. He thought he was converting it to ether or whatever, and he could have just been making the water gas, and it just it left the system. He wasn't trapping it, so it just left. And so that is a possibility. So in a nutshell, to look across the whole swath of the different projects, I've been seeing gradual increase in efficiency under these conditions, as people have been playing around with it. We've been studying Brown's gas, I guess, since the 80s, and I think Brown has his patent in the late 70s. And right away, he's seen some anomalies on the nature of the gas, and then I think the energy recognition of over-unity has occurred recently as people have gotten these refined versions of the experiment. And it's also nice is these are benchtop level experiments. These are all doable in the garage for people to play around with. And they're simply not hard. And there's been a lot of sharing. I think that's what really helped push it through on the web on the best ways to make these devices. And how to drive them.
How many people do you think, just a really rough guess, how many people would you say have replicated the phenomena through their own device?
Well, I can't say. Just I was in the study, I was just simply overwhelmed with the flood of information that was out on the web and the different people contributing. And many are, they're not big names or anything. They're just people that are honestly observing, you know, saying what they did and what they observed. And they're providing technical information that has led to, I think, improvements across the board for everyone. So different people contribute back. You know, you do the experiment, you say, man, this is a little trick that I did to help make it better. And you post that in the blogs or post it on the Water Fuel website. Then other people pick up on it and make another refinement, and they share that back. And so this thing has really taken off as far as far, far greater efficiency than it has been over the last few years. Most of standard Brown's gas, I think the frequency was too low and the plates were too widely spaced to really, you know, make over unity type claims. But now that on these smaller devices with the small spacing and the high frequency, they're starting to really show they're getting way excess energy production because they're producing way more gas for too little energy. And I think the biggest breakthrough occurred over the last year, where it's saying, gee, let's not just settle at one frequency, but let's keep trimming it in by changing, modulating the frequency until it constantly finds that sweet spot for the apparatus at any one moment for optimal gas production. And that's really pushing it over. So if everybody can get these effects...
You don't set the knob at one position, but you actually continually modulate it to stay at the sweet spot?
Yeah, and because the nature of the cell as it's running is constantly, you know, the parameters are constantly changing. So the exact resonant, total resonant point for maximal production would always be shifting.
That'd be neat if they can characterize what it is that they can measure to be able to tell whether they need to increase or decrease their frequency to stay right there on the sweet spot.
And that's just a feedback. You know, you just need a good sensor. Let's say it's gas production that you're trying to optimize. You know, people just do it visually. They kind of work the knob and watch the bubbling. And they see where they try to trim it in for maximum bubbling. I think that's how they first discovered that, gee, all we have to do is modulate the thing. They probably got, just by hand, just twiddled the knob and noticed, gee, when I'm twiddling it, it's far more active, so why don't I just make an automatic extra circuit to effectively twiddle the frequency? And that's what Zagoras did on his project.
Now, in an over-unity system, just because somebody surpasses 100% doesn't mean they have a practical system. They have to get, you know, 6 to 10 times over-unity before they have enough energy to keep the system itself running and have some left over for practical use.
That's correct.
What is the benchmark? What is the, in this system, at what point are we going to have a practical system where we can start running our cars, running appliances?
Well, I think we actually have it. There's many inventors that have claimed to have made water cars. And the only thing that's wrong with the claims is they keep saying water is the fuel. That's probably the only thing wrong is that's what makes the poor academic people ignore the whole field, because they know that's impossible. Water can't be the fuel. But if you're activating the vacuum energy and trapping it into the water gas cluster, now you have something. It's zero point energy is the fuel, and that's the medium by which you trapped it. And what's really nice about these experiments is they're very practical. People have retrofitted old cars, and they get them to run, and they just call them water fuel. And so that's probably the only thing wrong. It's just the name of the fuel source is wrong. Everything else is, they're right on track.
Could you give us a company or two to kind of keep our eye on, or is that proprietary?
I would just keep an eye on the web. I like the project coming out of Exogen in Canada. I cite them in the web talk because I like their cell. I've read the patent. Denny Klein's is kind of simple. It's only DC. He'll do a lot better if he shrinks the plate distance and drives it at AC, or drives it at pulse square waves at the appropriate frequency. Zagoras was stopped. There's suppression associated with all this, and so he had to bow out of the game. But enough information was left on the web that other people are picking up on it.
What about Bob Boyce?
I like Bob Boyce and what he said. The little bit I read, he said a couple critical things that are right on. Were the need to roughen the plates, the stainless steel plates that they use. They need to be rough. He would use sandpaper, and I believe Segoras would sandblast them in order to have very kind of sharp, dendritic, you know, microscopically, you want a nice, rough, pointy-type surface so that it produces, that's what you need to produce EVs as well. Very sharp points, gives you high field densities and things like that. That's what's used to launch the bubbles, and the bubbles don't stick to the plate. What's one of the problems in these devices? The bubbles tend to stick to the plate.
Mm-hmm.
Some people have used acoustical or mechanical stimulation to shake the bubbles off.
There was one person who was using a pulsed DC, so it's kind of like an AC-DC type of system, to shake the bubbles loose.
Yeah, well, pulsed DC is your excitation. When I talk about the frequency, these are pulsed square waves that are unipolar. The sharper the ride time, the better. And people have been experimenting with different duty cycles for the square wave. And with a good apparatus is one where you can change the width of the pulse and change the frequency at will, change the width of the pulse at will. And most of the MOSFETs that are used these days, you have digital control over those parameters. So it's quite easy to make to control it and make circuits that would control setting up the control parameters for optimal production. But when I've been talking these frequencies, I've meant that there's always a pulse unipolar square wave that's driving the cell at this particular frequency.
Let's talk for a second about the output gas from this process, the Brown's gas. Some people are running it into the air intake of a vehicle to increase the combustion efficiency, reduce emissions, and they're getting improvements anywhere from 30 to 50 or more percent in their fuel economy. Other people are using it for welding, and you know, and there's even some claims that Brown's gas has some nuclear remediation. It reduces significantly the number of isotopes that are radioactive. I may have said that wrong, but let's talk from a. Is there anything going on the interaction level as the gas is produced? It goes through the tube, interacts with the whatever it's doing, whether it's in a combustion chamber, in an internal combustion engine, or whether it's in a welding application. When the gas hits the substrate and reacts, is there anything going on that level that is on the zero-point energy harnessing spectrum, or is it only in the creation of the gas in the first place that we're seeing the zero-point energy being a source of the over-unity?
And the gas itself being the bubble or the cluster itself being in a high energetic state. That itself, in and of itself, is highly anomalous. And it interacts, it has a tendency to adhere to walls and to other gas molecules like gasoline. And that's why it's been used to as an efficiency enhancer for gasoline. It seems like that when you do that, it's an allowed, put that in quotes, project in the sense that you know, you're just saying, oh, I'm just catalyzing the burn of gasoline better, and there nobody has to be confronted with the paradigm shift of actually tapping into a whole new energy source like the zero-point energy. You can just simply say, oh, everybody knows you can use hydrogen to help catalyze the burning of gasoline so you can increase the fuel efficiency. No problem there. The big anomalies, of course, are when you run the car completely on the Brown's gas or these charged water collectors. And people have made different names as they come up with different theories. As you can see that across the web. different hypotheses have been proposed. But of course, if you want to claim you're truly over unity, you're going to have to say where the energy came from.
Mm-hmm. Now, if I remember right in your presentation, you did go into a little bit of modeling of how, on a quantum level, the electrolysis scenario harnesses or taps into, and in this conversation as well, you've alluded to some things. How would you capture that concept? How is it that the electrolysis is harnessing zero-point energy? What's
well,
the mechanism?
I wouldn't say it's electrolysis per se. I'd say it's the abrupt pulsing against the sharp points on the rough surface, microscopically speaking, of the plate. And we're creating the cluster, just like creating a charge cluster. So we're creating a charge water gas cluster with the abrupt pulsing event. And that's a self-organizing trigger that traps and coheres vacuum energy with within the nuclei participating in the cluster, water nuclei, or the nuclei of the atoms of water. And so the entire thing becomes a macroscopic, relatively speaking, macroscopic coherent form involving coherent vacuum energy and a coherent cluster that stays intact to be the water gas cluster. So that's basically the modeling, and of course it's a crude model that's only at a hypothesis level. Because it, you know, it has to be rigorously proven and studied, but it's certainly my front runner as far as what hypothesis to explain where the excess energy is coming from and why the water gas cluster is so strange in its behavior.
Mm-hmm. Now, in that, I had somewhere that I wanted to go with that, and I lost that train of thought. When we talk about the people who are running their vehicles on water, let's talk for a second on a practical level. Water is becoming a scarce element. I mean, I paid $1.50 for a quart of water today, and gas, you know, we're looking at that's the price of gas. And, you know, it was at an airport, and so it's going to be more expensive. But still, you know, we do live in on a planet where water is becoming more scarce, and so what kind of practical issues are we talking about? Or if we start using water as fuel when we need to be drinking the water, are we going to be able to use salt water? Are we going to be able to use unpurified water, culinary water? Are we going to be able to use non-potable water?
Hello.
Yes. Not only that, Exogen Technologies is looking at taking
Hello.
Junk water, and then through the process, when the gas recondenses, you get back water that's pure. In other words, water's going to water. So we take the water up to the charged water gas cluster, and then after you're done using it for energy, you're back to water. And so, and not only that, but you're back to pure water. So Exogen has been advertising their system is to be a water purifier. That's the company up in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Hello?
Yeah.
Who's on?
Anyone there? You guys hear me?
Somebody else jumped in on the air here.
I would like to talk to you guys.
Oh, do we have a call in?
Yes, you do.
Okay, go ahead. We have a caller.
Okay. I'd like to ask you guys a question. Now, all of the energy you're keep talking about regarding this program, do you believe that any of this type of work will actually would have an effect on the automobile business, which will create not the wheels to travel on wheels, but having to hover above the ground, or to like basically like a almost like a plane, but just hovering above ground?
In a short answer, yeah. When we understand the vacuum energy, we'll realize that it can warp the space-time metric and create gravitational propulsion. That's definitely a possibility, and there's a nice paper on it by Putoff, Cole, and Cole, and there's a third author, that that it's the basis of inertia, of the zero-point energy itself. It's the basis why inertia exists. If you get control of it, you control the inertia of anything, which gives you basically this type of flying saucer-like propulsion.
I've got a question for you in terms of talking about anti-gravity. There's a group of people, I should say a class of people, who believe that a lot of the UFO craft that are being observed are not from other planets, but are craft of this Earth origin of, you know, black op projects. What's your take on the amount of control or understanding of these technologies by the black op sector and the absconding of the technology, keeping it from civilian use? What's your take on that?
Yeah, that's I like Stephen Greer's description of it, and that's essentially it. I think the black ops are on top of all the stuff and know all about it, and that's that. I think the big fear would change things too much.
Well, they just want to leave the status quo.
Of course, the status quo is we go down the tubes anyway, right? So just, just stay on the way we're staying. Don't allow this discovery to come out. Everybody agrees we're pretty well going to doom our planet.
How close are we to generating a set of plans that are very clear, that will enable a person to build a device that they could power their homes or a device that could run their car?
Well, I think we're there. It's just these people that come up with it have to not be suppressed.
So it's just a matter of compiling the information and then disseminating it in an open-source way.
And then allowing people to do it as opposed to stopping them.
And we should mention that the patent of Stanley Myers, who had a car that allegedly ran on water, and there was some controversy about that, whether he actually was able to do that completely on water, or whether there was, you know, some other things going on. Of people who are adherents to this concept, who have come up with some controversy about that it wasn't quite what they claimed it to be, but still, you know, there were people claiming to run on water. But his patents are, as of July 2007, are expired, and so it's a free-for-all at this point.
Yeah, and Dave Watton has been doing a great job about sharing the details of exactly how to build a replication device. He's on the web.
Do you remember his website?
Yeah, I cited from my PowerPoint, but if you Google Dave Lawton with, I think it's L-A-W-T-O-N, with the word water fuel, you'll find him, because people reference him. They discuss, because he's been a fine contributor as far as getting replication, other people to replicate as well, because he's been so forthcoming in his detailed description.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's an example. Him and Patrick Kelly's paper, who is kind of team with Dave, have a lots of details on doing the Stan Meyer prototype replication.
Now, at this point, would it be fair to describe you as an aggregator of information? Do you see yourself possibly shifting at some point into actually becoming involved in a business that is taking this technology commercially to the market, implementing it, open sourcing it, something
where
it's actually...
As long as it's allowed. What I've seen is that as a business has their act together and they start to actually produce something for the marketplace, they get suppressed.
What about the gate technology?
To that happening, I think we just simply need massive replication by hobbyists.
Mm-hmm. What about the GEET technology? Is it a sister technology to what we're talking about?
Perhaps indirectly, not as direct as these pulsing systems for the charge glass clusters. I think he's discovered an anomaly associated with water vortexes, much like Schauberger. Discovered there seems to be energetic phenomena associated with certain types of vortices of water, and I think Paul Pantone made a dual vortex system in his manifold pipe, where he has one vortex on the inside, another vortex on the outside, and some plasma activity, and I do think that if plasma vortexes or ion vortexes are coheres and activate that could cohere the vacuum energy or the ether, if you prefer that name, and produce excess energy in such a system. And that has, of course, has to be investigated, replicated, and confirmed. But I think it's a possibility. I don't think it's quite, well, it might be easy. I don't know if there's reports of replication where other people just taking the plans, which are awesome, which are on Tesla Tech, the plans to build it. I don't see much in the way of reports of, oh, I'm getting this success by replicating the work. So I don't think it's going to be as easy as these newer miniature brown gas type cells where you pulse them at the high.
So TeslaTech.info has plans on the electrolysis, the brown gas?
Has Paul Pantone's plan for making the GEET technology. I don't know if I don't think I saw anything, unless they recently posted anything on the Browns Gas type projects, and that's not to my knowledge.
Well, we're coming to the end of our time. I really appreciate you joining us. This has been a fascinating chat, and I'm sure there's much, much more we could talk about. I would like to invite you and others who are interested in this to help us build some really good directories at our PezWiki website on this water gas and zero-point energy question, to chronicle the replications that are going on, to kind of categorize the different types of electrolysis units and what's working best and what's working, what's not, and to have a listing of the different water cell discussion lists, and kind of help people get the lay of the land in a very clear thumbnail overview, so they can then delve into whichever particular area that they find to be most interesting for them personally. You know, there's a whole lot of areas of specialty that could be pursued in this particular field. And we will have, as I said, I just barely posted a page on this, and I as soon as we get off the phone, I'll be linking to the PowerPoint, which I have uploaded to freeenergynews.com, and we'll have a link from peswiki.com. That's P-E-S-W-I-K-I. Do you have a website, Morey, that people can go to that kind of is a collection of your works?
Not directly, but if you just Google my name, you'll get to my material, because a lot of people posted it.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, I have three books.
Oh.
Out. The newest book is The Energy Machine of T. Henry Morey. And my first book was Tapping the Zero-Point Energy, and my second book was Quest for Zero-Point Energy.
Very good. Well, thank you again for joining us, and you've been listening to the Free Energy Now show. You can see our past archives at freeenergynow.net, and you will be able to, of course, if you're listening to this, you already know how you got a recording of this, but that's where we post our archive, where people can download past shows, and this one will be up there as soon as we get her ready. It usually takes 2 to 3 days before it's there. And join us every day at freeenergynews.com. We do have a daily newsletter that is free. It comes to your email with 3 to 5 stories of hot breaking news stories from around the planet along the lines of free energy and these types of technologies. They're outside the box, but seem to have working prototypes and reason to believe that they're real technologies. So thank you for joining us, Moria. We appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much, darling.
You're welcome.
Listening to Free Energy Now, brought to you by PES, Pure Energy Systems. You may access past archives and upcoming show info at freeenergynow.net, and join us for our daily news at freeenergynews.com. We invite you to see our directory of energy technologies at peswiki.com. That's peswiki.com. PES, the Pure Energy Systems Information Network.